Thank you for inviting me here. My name is Ravi Sanghani, and I'm here to talk today about some AMs of decaying isotropic combustible turbines and some shockwave statistics. My collaborators in this work are Professor Pullen and Brian Kulkarni, who is a postdoc
working with both of us.
I would also like to acknowledge discussion to several of the faculty at Galpin, and in particular mention Kareem Sharif and Alan Ray of NASA Ames, who helped me get started on this. And of course, I would like to acknowledge the funding of the DOE under the ICAFAP program and company. The outline of the presentation is going to be the following. I'm going to spend a few minutes introducing what we do and why we do that. Talk a little bit about the equations and numerical methods. Spend some time on kinematic relations with our biology for isotropic compressible turbines. And spend most of my time talking about influence of initial conditions present in the results of the DNS and the shockwave quantifications and statistics. It's always a good idea to look at the heavens for some inspiration. So I downloaded some figures from the Space Telescope Science Institute. The one on the left is the so-called Baikonur Nebula, and the one on the right is the Cacti Nebula. And one which I'm not showing here is the Orion Nebula, I think, based on this slide. So to read the captions of these images, they talk about turbine cauldron of starburst. They talk about maelstrom of starburst, turbine starfire phase, high-speed jets of gas. So I think the astrophysicists are pretty convinced that turbines play a very important role. It's also clear, if you see some of these pictures, that you see a lot of shock in these turbines. And while the flow is compressible and turbulent, I'm not going to make any assumptions about its isotropy. But that's a trick that theoreticians have to use. For us at Caltech, the motivation is a more down-to-earth, mundane motivation. Caltech is involved in designing the ASCII virtual test facility, one of which configuration is the one shown here on the right. We're going to initiate a detonation in a high explosive charge. The detonation will then transmit into test materials. If these test materials happen to be gases, and if furthermore they're separated by a membrane, and as the detonation of the shockwave goes over this interface, it initiates the rate measurement of instability. And I'm sure you must have heard from Norm work on the Rickman Metcalf instability. So during the Rickman Metcalf instability, you have a lot of compressible turbine mixing which ensues. Here's again by way of motivation, just a cartoon slide. Actually, this is from a real numerical simulation. Pay no attention to the details except that there was a gas interface here which was sharp. The shock reflected off the end wall. And after reshock, the interface between the two gases and the mean velocity of here is just sort of fixed there, and you see the mixing layer increase in size. If you zoom in to this, you see that there's a lot of turbine mixing going on. So it's clear that there is decaying turbulence going on in the mixing region. Again, the mean flow is zero, and one can perhaps get away with the assumption that it may be isotropic, although there's no evidence to prove that yet. So really one of our motivations was to be able to do a large energy simulation of the kind that you saw before. And to do that, we are developing and developing subgrid scale models to do large energy simulations in compressible turbines. So in order to do that, first we decided we needed a database of decaying isotropic turbines at high resolution so that we could verify the subgrid scale models that are being developed. And one point to note is that decaying isotropic turbines is actually a pretty hard test case for our years. So the equations of motion are the Navier-Stokes equations which we simulate. They are written down here in strong conservation form. The point to note is that the we have a temperature dependent viscosity, and we close the equation with the perfect gas equation state. To solve these equations numerically, we first choose a domain which has a size of 2 pi in each of the Cartesian directions. We also choose periodic boundary conditions, and the numerical method of choice is a high order compact finite difference, and the Stokes method due to Lely and others before him. A code was written so that we have a flexible order of finitely, we can vary the order from 2 to 10. The time margin was a low storage third order on the cutter. I developed a parallel code which has good scalability properties on a variety of ASCII platforms.
Is there a reason why you did go see the spectral?
Yes and no. The one reason is that superspectral is more expensive than compressible, because you don't have the advantage of inverting the pressure. You don't have a constant pressure. That advantage is lost. Besides, you have a triple nonlinearity in the momentum equation. And to do de-aliasing of that implies you need a box at least twice the size of your domain. If you do starting with zeros and then de-aliasing. So that can't be expensive.
Can you go do de-aliasing?
I'm going to address the de-aliasing in this next two slides. I'm not going to spend any more time here, except that the question is whether one can alias or not alias, or do the aliasing in turbulence. All I wanted to point out is that if you use compact finite difference schemes, if I take a function, I take its derivative. If I'm using a spectral method which is completely resolved, the derivative is going to be ik times uk. What the compact finite difference scheme does is it puts a factor here, it modifies the wave number. So inherently there's a built-in low pass filter in the standard compact finite difference scheme. And as of today, I am not clear how to do the aliasing for a compact finite difference scheme. I mean, if you're indeed going to do the aliasing, you might as well go for a second.
Do you know what this low pass filter looks like?
Yes, the next slide. You have a patient with me.
Right.
So if I do a spectral method, then the modified wave number versus the wave number is going to be just a diagonal line. If you use 10th order, you see that it's nearly spectrally accurate, and then you have dissipation at very high wave numbers. And that can help us if we have shockless in the flow. You can see that a second order method is completely inappropriate to do turbulence. I mean, you have wave number dissipation.
It's not really dissipation, is it? Isn't it really just filtering?
It's filtering, yeah. Final word on the to be or not to be earlier question is we use a skew symmetric form for the cubic nonlinearity in the momentum equation as here to reference Blaisdell, who first suggested this in his thesis. What one can analytically actually show is that this form reduces, it does not eliminate, but it reduces the linearity. A few words about some notation and definitions. We are going to define a Taylor microscale, and I will talk about the Taylor Reynolds number. Defined as follows: this RMS velocity by average density times the Taylor microscale defined here, divided by average viscosity. We are also going to frequently refer to a turbulent Mach number, which is defined as the RMS speed divided by an average sound speed. That definition is a little different from the RMS Mach number, which people define as follows. Turns out that numerically, for the cases we looked at, the difference between these two definitions numerically is not that large or small. Another quantity I will frequently refer to is the divergence, which is defined by theta, and I'm going to talk about the root mean square divergence of the velocity, denoted by theta prime. Before I move on to results of DNS, there are some interesting kinematic relations one can derive for compressible isotropic turbulence. It turns out that we went through this exercise and we didn't realize that there was already existing in the literature similar results which were derived by Moya in 1951. Nevertheless, because these are kind of obscure relations, I thought I might still go through the analysis in brief. So one can take the velocity field and do a Hubble's decomposition of a solenoid and a compressible component. This components, the flow free, the divergence free. One can write a total velocity covariance defined as Rij between points x and x prime, where x prime is separated by a position vector r. And substituting this into this relation, so can be written as using the three tensors. One is the solenoidal covariance tensor, one is the compressible covariance tensor, and one is the mixed tensor. And you can show that in homogeneous isotropic terms, it's very important, that Rij is simply a function of the distance between the two points, and not R itself. And that can be written in a general second order tensor as follows. But AR is longitudinal correlation and BR is lateral correlation. And AR and BR are functions of the separation, and that's shown here. So in principle, one can actually put a probe, if one is inclined to do so, and measure the longitudinal velocity correlation AR and lateral velocity correlation BR in an experiment. So going back and substituting these forms into the covariance sensor, one can actually figure out that the solenoidal part of the covariance sensor can now be defined in terms of f functions f of r, which is basically the longitudinal correlation between the solenoidal components only, and the compressible part of the covariance sensor has a function g of r, which is a correlation between the lateral compressible components of the velocity only. And turns out that identically, for isotropic turbulence, the cross correlation tensor is zero. And so the total covariance tensor can be now written in terms of GR and FR, which actually satisfy following ODEs. Again, I'm going to skim over the analysis. It's important to note that in order to solve these ODEs, you have boundary conditions, which is an F of zero is the solenoidal part of this kinetic energy, is a fraction of the kinetic energy in the solenoidal component, and G of zero is that of the compressible. And one can actually write down analytical equations for these. Eventually, in the end, it turns out that one can actually get velocity spectra in terms of FR and GR written by these two equations. Let me go back and remind you that FR and GR are functions of AR and BR, which can be experimentally measured quantities. And so if you measure experimentally the longitudinal and the lateral correlations, you can actually get the velocity spectrum for the solenoidal and the compressible component. And at the time we derived it, we didn't find any such derivation in the literature. And unlike incompressible turbulence, where one can write a dynamical equation for E of S, one cannot do that for, it's actually not clear to me how to do that for compressible turbulence. So the question is whether this kind of work is dynamically significant. Definitely of kinematic importance, but not the dynamical significance is not clear. So similar results were actually derived by Moyle in the proceedings of the Cambridge Philosophical Society in 1951.
A rather obscure paper which seems to have been lost.
Let me talk about the DNS runs. This is just a table showing the kind of runs we did. We did several exploratory 128-qubit runs and three high-resolution 256-qubit runs which were done. This is actually 72. So the Taylor-Reynolds number initially for high-resolution runs was higher than 150, and the Durbin Mach number was 0.4 and 0.488. This here shows just what kind of initial conditions which were used, and I'm going to talk about that in the next couple of slides.
So this R lambdas are for the initial conditions.
That's correct.
I'll show you how long we went in time.
The first thing we did was to verify the code, so I took some incompressible data sets from Alan Ray and ran the code at low Mach number. And the decubed kinetic energy was plotted, and it reproduced Alan Ray's results very nicely. So that gave us some confidence, and the code was verified. It also preserved mass and energy to machine precision.
And actually, another independently written code was also tested and gave the same answers. That was written by Fosage.
For incompressible turbulence, it is very clear, or at least it seems to be clear, how to start off the calculation. We specify a solenoidal velocity spectrum, which is typically of this form. K naught is the spectrum, is the wave number at which the spectrum peaks. But it's not clear what to do for compressible turbulence. So we went through an exercise of how to go about initializing the thermodynamic variables for compressible turbulence. The first thing one can do, and I'm going to call four kinds of initial conditions that we investigated, IC1, 2, 3, and 4. So IC1 is the divergence-free velocity field. Furthermore, if you assume that the time rate of change of divergence at t equal to 0 is 0, one can derive a Poisson equation for the pressure, which has to be iteratively solved because sigma ij now contains a temperature-dependent viscosity. So you iteratively solve it, and you get a flow field which has pressure, temperature, and density, but no density fluctuation for IC1. So you have uniform density initially. Second thing we tried was IC2, which is with a non-zero initial divergence. This is based on small turbulent mass number expansion of the Navier-Stokes equation. The details are in a paper by Ristorcelli and Blaisdell. It's a fairly complicated procedure. Turns out that you get fluctuations of all the thermodynamic variables for that description. Third was a divergence-free but homentropic initial condition. Again, if you assume that this is true, one can derive a Poisson equation for temperature, which can be, again, iteratively solved because now you have a density and a temperature-dependent viscosity. What you get is no fluctuations of entropy, but fluctuations in density, temperature, and pressure. And finally, IC4, which is divergence-free and initially homentropic, has no fluctuation on any of the thermodynamic constants, the simplest one to implement. So, to see the influence of initial conditions, we did some exploratory 128 cube run. So this is the plot of divergence RMS as a function of time, which is normalized by the Zahir-Eddy term over time at zero. So we went up to 8, typically between 7 and 6 to 8 Zahir-Eddy term over time. So you see that for IC4, which has no fluctuations at all initially, we have very rapid rise of theta prime and then that decays. IC1 and 3 also start from 0, but they don't go as high as IC4, and then they kind of follow each other very closely. IC2 has initial divergence with sort of decay in this case. This was for a double Mach number 0.3, so we decided that the largest difference is between IC2 and IC4, repeated it for turbulent Mach number of 0.1, again, you see the high difference between IC4 and IC4. And similar dependence was also noted by Blaisdell and Ristorcelli. They performed some more calculations and then looked at some statistics. For turbulent Mach number of 0.5, which is fairly high now, we see that the skewness for IC2 and IC4 differ, but not by a lot. But the interesting thing is for all those cases, all the 128 cube cases, irrespective of the initial conditions used and irrespective of the Mach number, why plot the kinetic energy as a function of time? You can see that they all sort of collapse on each other. So it seems that the decay of kinetic energy at lower turbulent Mach numbers is, and for the initial conditions that we use, is immaterial what kind of initial condition procedure you use. So, from now on, the results I show will be mostly all IC4 except the case D10, which is IC2. D9, D10, D11 are the four large resolution cases. So if I plot the TKE decay as a function of time, you see two clear curves here. One is these are the high resolution simulations at a higher Taylor uniform, and these are the lower resolution 128 cube simulations which have an initial Taylor Reynolds number which is smaller than this one. And one can also do a log plot, and you can see that there is some semblance of power law decay of TKE at late times. And that's something I was quantifying in a couple of slides. So if you look at the time rate of change of kinetic energy, it has three components. One is the dissipation due to compressibility effects, one is the solenoidal dissipation. And there's a transfer term, which is the correlation between the pressure and the dimensions. So for one case, this is the highest level Mach number case, highest error in our case. And the initial conditions were of the simplest kind, the IC4. If you look at the dissipation rate, the total dissipation is given by red and the solenoid is by green. You see that the difference is very small. What happens initially is that you very rapidly, because P theta is now very large here, very rapidly take energy from the solenoid board and put it in the compressor. But nevertheless, from the back end, it's close to zero. The blue dark back line is the compressible part of the dissipation, and that's very negligible for this. So this feature, that compressible dissipation, is too small, is something which we will use later in the talk. Yes?
For the same resolution with different initial conditions, if you were to plot our lambda up to say 6 cities over time, are they about the same?
You're preempting me. So for different, so look at the yellow curve, which is the highest Taylor Reynolds number case, and look at D10 and D11, which D10 is both a high resolution calculation, but this is of initial conditions too, and this is of YT4, which is completely different. They're the most disparate initial conditions you can think of. And look at the Taylor Reynolds number, the blue, the black, and the purple curve. So the Taylor Reynolds number follows.
Is that 100 eddy turn over time?
About 10.
10.
So we haven't gone very. So one can also do a quantification of the density fluctuation. So RMS density fluctuation. Now we normalize that by the initial turbulent Mach number square, and that kind of scaling is adjusted by a Rayleigh-Hanson expansion. You see, again, two clear curves emerge. Again, they are differing by Reynolds numbers. But this kind of collapse, especially for these, we have all turbulent Mach number 0.1, 3, and 5. For IC4, that kind of clearing seems to collapse curves pretty well. So,
is any power low in time?
Here it is. We looked at the TK power laws as, by expressing them as follows, we have a shift of the time axis, and n is the power law exponent, and one can look at various, this is incompressible, this is compressible, point, Mach number 0.1, 0.3, and 0.5, and these D9, D10, D11 are the high resolution runs, and you can look at the power law exponent, and they vary typically from lowest between 1.37 to 1.71. Now, incompressible DNS of isotropic homogeneous turbulence was also undertaken by Huang and Leonard, and they have a model which gives them a value of 3.5. One can use a Karman Hauer similarity theory, which will give you n equals 1, which is not really close to what we observe. One can assume a Lorentzian speed invariant, that gives you n 1.33, which is on the lower side. A Sackmann invariant, assuming it's a constant Sackmann invariant, will give you n equals 1.2, which is again on the lower end. But in general, these exponents agree well with the incompressible PKE power of again. And we also did it for the Reynolds numbers and the fluctuating density.
No, why D10 is so different?
That's the different initial conditions. That's the IC2 for rho. That starts off initially with the rho prime. Doesn't have rho prime initially for the other case.
We said incompressible and compressible are the same, so that means that 1.5 and 1.66 are about the same. Is that what you mean? Or not?
The numbers are in the same ballpark. I can't say that they are identical.
Okay, I mean close.
They're close. Leonard and Huang got something that was close to 1.5. They have a model for it, so give them
1.5.
Is that
for compressible or
incompressible? If one looks at theta prime as Q-ness, I'm going to show you theta prime for all the runs, for many of the runs. And what you see is if you start with zero divergence initially, typically what you see is very rapid rise in divergence, and the rise is larger the larger the turbulent Mach number is. And then it decays in time. And if you look at Q-ness, because the initially the amplitude phase is uncorrelated, what we get is zero initially. That's what rapidly decreases, undergoes some large fluctuations, and then settles down to some more conventional wisdom merger between minus 0.4 and minus 0.5. And we have plotted basically all the three components of this QNS sensor, the three diagonal components, and you can actually see that it also tells you how isotropic your turbulence really is. But we note that, again, because of the rapid rise in data time, and that's the phase when really shocklets develop, that kind of limits how high in turbulent mass number and Reynolds number you can go. So a combination of both limits. If you increase turbulent mass number very high, you can't really go up very high in turbulent time in the Reynolds number. So the core cannot cope with it.
That's the real answer.
Theta prime is the divergence of velocity.
Yes. In the RMS of the network.
RMS of the divergence of velocity, so it's in arbitrary units. Is there any appropriate thing to scale it on or to normalize it with?
Yeah, that's a good question. We have thought about it, but haven't come up with anything convincing yet. I'm sure there is.
Yeah, yeah. It's sort of hard to interpret those numbers.
Yeah.
What's big and what's small.
Right, I agree. So, if we look at the largest turbulent Mach number and largest Taylor-Reynolds number case, plot the spectra for a variety of times. These are compensated spectra, so you multiply them with epsilon to the 2/3 and k to the 5/3. Plot them against k eta. This black line is the initial spectrum, and then these are the spectrum for later times. One has to really use one's imagination to see an inertial range there.
Sure.
Well, you can imagine that there is a little bit.
Yeah. Don't imagine.
Okay. Okay, this is really a minor. I can also plot the spectra of the divergence. For this case, initially it was zero. And k squared ECK is really twice the prime squared. So this really is the divergence spectra. What you see is zero. And then initially it really shows this broad band. The red line is the divergence spectra very quickly after the run starts. You can see that it's quite broadband and that's how it is. Again, so we think that this broadband spectra could be also indicative of shocklets. Shocklets were first observed by Lee, Lele, and Moen in a Physics for Fluids publication in almost a decade ago. They proved that these things exist. Before I move on to shocklets, I want to say something about the PDF of longitudinal velocity differences. This is a result which we will use later on in a model. We plot the PDF of velocity differences normalized on the x-axis by the standard deviation, the RMS value. You see that one can fit an exponential form to the tail of P of delta U for the negative values of delta U. This form was proposed by Proskowski and Onkley in a Fizer-Wendler's paper where they did this for atmospheric turbulence. Yeah, they observed very large, they had very large Reynolds numbers. But we find that this form actually appropriately fits our data as well. The quantities alpha and beta from DNS vary from 1.5 to 1.75. Beta should be given your product, approximately 0.16.
Excuse me, which curve is Proskowski?
This is the form that they give. All these curves are from our DNA.
I'm not sure.
No, not sure. That's the form which we borrowed from them. So moving on to the part about shocklets, what you see here is really a snapshot of the velocity divergence field. Taken for the largest turbulent Mach number case, what you see is that what I try to highlight in this figure is these thinly animal, these red areas, these are areas of very large negative divergence.
We identify it.
The divergence field. This is the volume rendered divergence field.
Okay.
So you would expect that shocks where you would see very large negative divergence. And you see that you can see these are thinly structures which are the shocklets. So what we did is we said, okay, we observe shocklets, let's try to extract them. So we did an extension of a 2D shock and heart attack extension algorithm. Actually, I failed to mention that Norm and I also did this, extended this work, and we have a publication on that coming up. So for the 3D case, what I'm going to do is I'm going to define shocklets as a set of disjoint surfaces. And each surface, each shocklet may be simply or multiply connected. And we are going to define, this is an operational definition of a shocklet, is an area, is a set of, is a surface in the flow where the Laplacian of the density field is zero. This is like if you look at a 1D shock, with the shock structure. One can say that the center of the shock is where you have the inflection point in the density. So the similar idea is here. We said that that's where the negative layer, the divergence, the Laplacian of the density is zero. The surface which defines the shock length. Furthermore, the divergence on this surface should be larger than 3 times the R square. That tends an arbitrary expression. Works well for us, but that's really a weak point in the algorithm. Threshold has to be set in common. So then, went ahead and modified the Martin cubes algorithm to generate an isotropic which satisfies this equation with the condition that divergence has to be larger than 3 times the R. Eventually, in the end, you go through the words and you get a list of triangles which satisfy that. And you can do a recursive surface growing algorithm for each of these triangles. And you can see one can actually expand shocklets. What you see is that they have like, they depict like these ribbon like surfaces in the flow. So now that we have extracted them, we want to actually quantify them and see that they indeed are shocklets. So what we do is for each of these surfaces, now each of these surfaces comprises of triangles. For all the triangles, we're going to calculate a unit normal vector. And by trilinear interpolation, we're going to go along the normal direction and the negative of the normal direction. We pick out some point and we compute the pressure and density ratio across these points. Of course, if the pressure ratio minus 1 times the density ratio minus 1 is less than 0, that is for gas dynamics, an impossibility if it's a shock. So that means it's a failure of the algorithm and we just want to skip that triangle. Furthermore, if the pressure is less than 1, we just invert the ratio. We chose the wrong normal direction. The next thing we do is you're going to compute a penalty function along this normal direction. And this penalty function is sort of reminiscent of Rankine Newton-Gibbs conditions. What you're going to say, you're going to do that pressure and density ratio across the shock with the index L where this penalty function is a minimum. So we enforce it to minimize the error. So what we see is we want to see if the extracted chocolate now satisfy the jump conditions. So we take all the points and we measure the pressure ratio and density ratio. Remember, this is a log-log plot, sort of expanding the error now. The green line is the ideal euglenium, and red dots are the extracted shocks from the DNF layer. And for one case, this agrees pretty well. There's some failure of the shocklet algorithm to pick out extremely weak shocks, and there's some standard failure. This is another case with the turbulent Mach number and that, so that this is point. These numbers are number. The Taylor Reynolds number is so forget about these numbers. These, again, for a different test case, you see that we still are able to pick out the shocklet, which do satisfy the jump condition to a reasonable approximation. Now we have a box of turbulence with shocklets distributed in it, and what we want to know is, what is the PDF of the shocklet strength? And really, ideally, one should choose the pressure ratio as a measure of the shock strength, but most people like to think in terms of Mach number. So what we did was, instead of a pressure ratio, we're going to say that if this shock was stationary, what would be the normal Mach number of that shock? So we take a weak shock theory, and one can get a velocity difference across the shock. This is given by this. This is actually an exact result, it's not approximate yet. But for a weak shock, one can say that the thickness of the shock is given by this result. I think this was originally derived by Taylor. So now we're going to say that because that we had a PDF of longitudinal velocity differences for negative velocity jumps, that was this. I'm going to say that we assume that this is uniformly valid for delta U less than 0. Furthermore, that was from an incompressible atmospheric turbulence paper that we took this form, you're not going to make an emphasis, but the effect of moderate Mach number on this form of the velocity PDF, and this PDF for the velocity difference is going to be formed. So we take that expression, and we're going to now estimate delta U square in the dissipation rate, and one can do that from relation to isotropic compressible turbulence. So you go through the algebra, which is not very complicated. Eventually you get a form for delta U over sigma delta U, which has just the Reynolds number and the turbulent Mach number and the Mach number of the shock associated with it. So I'm actually a few steps here, but basically you can see that going back to this PDF now, this has alpha r to the beta. We're going to now assume that beta is zero for simplicity, and get a PDF of shocklet distribution in this flow. If you assume that beta is non-zero, you can still derive it. It's more complicated expression, it involves gamma function. Numerically, the difference between the two forms is small. So we chose the simpler form. That's the PDF of shocklet spring, which really is a normalized PDF. But going from 0 to infinity is 1. Well, that tells you also that the most probable shock Mach number is related to the turbulence Mach number and the inverse of the square root of the Taylor Reynolds number. So how does this actually fit the DNS database? So for one case, we looked at, we got a very good agreement. I mean, the peaks are sort of in the right place, and the form is pretty much in the right place. This was the highest turbulent Mach number Taylor Reynolds number case. The symbols are from DNS, and the green line is from normal. One can do that for the other two cases, the other two high resolution cases we had, because now this case, the turbulence Reynolds number was small and the Mach number was smaller, so you don't expect as good an agreement, but nevertheless, we still, there's some scatter, but the peaks are sort of in the right place, and the agreement is reasonable, given all the assumptions we have made.
What is the red squares correspond to one more time? Red squares.
The time is here.
So.
This is PDF versus the Mach number of the shunt.
Okay, the green line is the DNS.
This green line is our model, and the symbols are from the DNS.
Which
Mach
number is
M sub n
again?
It's the Mach number. Think of it as the pressure ratio of the shunt.
Okay, alright.
So if you were in a
shock or frozen, right.
Because people like to think it's just a Mach number and pressure.
So they're all fairly close to 1, all of the Mach numbers.
So if you take a PDF, just as a digression, if you take a PDF of divergence normalized by the RMS, this is the threshold that we use, and this is a long linear plot. So really what you see is that the maximum area possible occupied by the shocklet will be this area of the PDF on the left. And that area turns out to be less than 2%. So these chocolates occupy a very little force volume in the equilibrium. One can go further and now say we can estimate a shock thickness. Again, remember we are doing for weak shock. In the weak shock limit, and you see that the shock thickness now scales rather to beta, to more than 0, than the mean free quantity gap. That's what the model is. One can also get a PDF of shock thicknesses. And you note that for very weak shocks of large thickness, PDF has an inverse to ratio. That's given by that. So these are, for weak Mach number turbulence, you get shocks which scale in the Kolmogorov scale. So
is that because the shocklets are definitely weak?
Yes, you're making assumptions that they are weak. And indeed they are. You can see from the DNA, most of them, the bulk of them, the PDF are very weak. So, in a sense, if you are able to resolve, because simulation is resolved in the sense that you resolve your promoter of scale, or in other words, my conventional wisdom is K maximum, minimum, the time K that is 1 or larger, you have resolved eta, you have resolved the weakest shock for the number. One can also get a most probable shock thickness in terms of eta. So in the entire business, again, I want to emphasize that we used the model, the Mach number was low, in the morning, and that we neglect the really shock coverage or non-sediments. So shocking, so and again, these are seem to be high order effects. So in conclusion, we went through some kinematic relations for compressible. We have a Navier-Stokes support, and we are now generated the database of decaying isotropic compressed disturbance against which we are now comparing LES with. We investigated four types of initial conditions. The decaying decay was insensitive to the initial conditions. We developed an algorithm to extract shortcuts from DNS data, and we derived a model for PDF of shortcuts given here. And we found that the most probable shortcut mass number scales as MC to the square root of the Taylor Reynolds number. That is the most probable shock thickness scales as A. What this does still say, if you look at the PDF, remember the PDF, you still have some outlier shocks. These are sort of reasonably strong shocks. You could still get a Mach 1.1 shock. What that implies is that even the existence of a single shock, which is of reasonable strength, because they're using a global method, a compact value system, it could contaminate the environment. And you can look at it.
In the dissipation scale,
is the Kolmogorov. Yeah,
the you could also say that the generic contaminates shockless as well. Even Kmax eta of 1, if you actually take the ratio of your grid spacing to the Kolmogorov space, it's probably like 4 or 5.
Yeah.
So it might be worthwhile to do a really highly resolved simulation and live with a lower Reynolds number in order to see whether you pick up higher strength shocks.
Correct.
Because you still lose these amounts by a lot.
Right. So this is something that we plan to do. Let me just go back to the table. So in my data for at least for the higher resolution run.
Yeah, but that's the initial.
I
really think it's inappropriate to quote R lambda and Kmax data at the initial time. You should quote it at six eddington over time. You should replace those numbers because they really
this number actually
gets bigger.
So it gets smaller initially.
Yeah.
And then it gets bigger. And so it was 2.45 initially, and it went down to 1.8
for
the largest level 1.75 initially for the other two and went down to 1.5. So in as far as people who do incompressible they think this is a well resolved calculation.
Yeah, no, I agree that it's when you've got your shocks that are sort of at the overall scale. I think this is really interesting what you've done.
Well, actually, it turns out that the most problem shock Mach number, the most problem shock thickness is actually 4 times greater.
Roughly 4 times.
Roughly.
So it's right at your cell. It's right at your grid cell.
Yeah.
And in fact, what you're de-aliasing is still smaller than your grid cell.
Yeah. So the thing is, I think most problem shock are 45 different micrometers.
But your R lambdas, I don't know, is seen at 6 eddington on the order of 25, 30. Yeah, so I mean, they're really.
But this shock, this shock, this extraction was done at the time when R lambda was on. The comparison is sure between the model.
But it's in decay, it's in power law decay. At that point, you certainly don't want to do it before you get into power law decay.
Well, it's at a time when we think that the turbulence is fully developed in the sense that the Q&S has settled down.
As planned.
Yeah. But let me go back to the
chat. I know we have to.
So the shortcut extraction for the largest turbulent Mach number case was done last 3 years. The problem is if you wait till here, your turbulent Mach number is so small that you won't be able to
shock
it.
Right, no, I know.
I have one more question. recovering. Whatever happened to that, all that good stuff, the Moyal decomposition, things you had some kinematic relations, and they didn't have any dynamical significance. So what was it then?
Well, we derived them at the time when we couldn't find relations of that nature. We wanted to, for example, relate data points to the data points, for example, to be twice the integral of 0 to k k squared e t d k. And relations like that, I couldn't find anywhere. So we went ahead and derived it much later. Only recently we noticed that.
Yeah.
There was some work going on. The other point about the derivation is that if you can measure experimentally, just two-point measurements, the longitudinal and the lateral velocity correlation function, you're not doing any decomposition between solar and motion. You just give me AR and AR. And I can give you a spectrum for the solar angle and the compression.
Yeah.
That was, at least to me, surprising that you could just take two-point measurements and give separate the two components, the solenoid and the compression, and actually get the spectrum out.
This is because that's just kinematics.
It's kinematics, but it didn't
start. Don't degrade kinematics.
it's just in the final analysis, it's just kinematics.
Well, but the simulation is a dynamic simulation, okay? And you're extracting an energy spectrum is a kinematic quantity, but it's a result of the dynamical evolution.
Could
you normalize state of time by vorticities and mass from vorticity? Do you have a measure of relative importance?
Yes, you can do that. You could take In the dissipation relation, you get 4 thirds mu times theta square, and you get mu times omega square.
Yeah.
So you could normalize that. And if you do normalize it by that, what you see is that because the compressible dissipation was negligible compared to the solenoidal, it would be, that ratio would be small number.
I would think the interval time scale would be the most appropriate time scale, wouldn't you?
Well, this is related to the time scale, isn't it?
Well, the ratio of the vorticity time scale is related to the Kolmogorov time scale.
Oh, I see.
I would do both, actually. I would scale it on both, you see. Scale it on the Kolmogorov time scale and scale it on the integral time scale.
I agree, that's a very good point. I mean, this is something we have been negligent. We should have normalized it.
Well, I just want to make a point that this chocolate extraction idea is not a small thing. It's a really nice accomplishment, algorithmically, in terms of what is there in my solution. You know, it's also visualizing what's going on in physical space rather than in case space. And I think it's extremely important to the astrophysicists who are not here. Because they're constantly now asking them, what is the shock population in the flow in the real heavens, but certainly in their calculations. And how many shocks are interacting with, what is the curvature of the shock, what is the mean curvature? All that information is available. And it's independent of the fact that whether you resolve it's actually very important because he actually checks it against the Rankine and Grönemeyer relations for a resolving, because most of the calculations that they do are unresolved in the sense that there's no viscosity in the calculation. So establishing the truth of shock dynamics within the flow, this algorithm will play a very important role in the future. I was going to ask the question, have you ever looked at the shocks to see if they're singly connected or multiply connected?
So the results I presented today, I actually present at the time that I extract the shocks.
Oh, it's very early.
Here.
Yeah.
But if you go here, so in this time, this is where we get the shocks. But if you go here, when the flow is initially developing, you have a lot more shocks. They look much more complicated. And in fact, They're not necessarily simply connected. You see, like, you can even, I got some with, like, annular flows with asking why am I there?
What is the fear?
But I did not choose that because I wanted to recover with my choice exactly at the time that we expected.
Yeah. Do you have any sense for whether these chakras, if I had to guess where these chakras are forming, I would say they would be in between the regions of concentrated vorticity.
And
have you looked at that at all?
No, we have not looked at that, but it has been pointed out in really early and more that they call them eddy chakras. I think it was originally their hypothesis. I could be wrong about this, but it was their hypothesis that this for the fourth effect, we form the shock between two or six two.
Right, that's what I mean.
And in fact, okay, so
you can also
go back to a very early slide that I showed that. This is from a real simulation. The vorticity is red, and the thresholds are arbitrarily chosen. But you can see that.
What's the blue?
Blue is the valid. So you can see that they are not necessarily correlated. They are sort of in between.
I'd be surprised if they were.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Didn't Larry and Moyle also observe chocolates on the outside of the vorticity, not necessarily in the full region?
I remember
that Tom Shardig and I did the vortex gargle.
That's right.
And the dominant shock was in the throat. But there were also chocolates on the outside. And also away from the center of vorticity. They're all away from the center of vorticity.
Like a cartwheel, right? You have the center hub and then.
That's right.
Yeah. I have those.
So that you could get the point. They're usually much smaller. As the flow is turning.
Yeah.
But the dominant chakra is in the throat of the drive plate.
Yeah. You want to just correlate them with the vorticity squared minus strain squared invariant?
Yeah, you could.
Presumably
yeah.
They'll sit where quite strained.
That's a Laplacian pressure.
That's it. You should actually read correlation.
That's a good question. Yeah, we haven't really. It's hard to hard to differentiate in DNF which comes from Moa.
Yeah.
If you, unless you do very careful data analysis.
Yeah, yeah.
So we haven't done that yet. That's a very good point. Actually, in a few years ago, there was a paper by Himine, Safman, Rugao, and Ray, where they talked about vortex worms. These are sort of passive structures, which intense vorticity structure, which basically are dynamically not very significant, it seems. I haven't read that paper carefully myself. It's, what I'm saying is what I've heard in conversations with Fulham and Boston. So it turns out that one can make an analogy between that and the shockless here. Shockless, we see them, they're sort of ubiquitous, but they are very thin surfaces and the volume they occupy is very small. And they're dynamically not very significant. They're significant in the sense that they can ruin your numerics. Because they can contaminate the numerics, because if it's a strong shock, it's strong enough shock. Because we are doing a global method, you can get this phenomenon. Numerical instability. In fact, if we pump up the Mach number initially, if I try to do a total Mach number of one calculation, the code will crash, because what you see is you get a lot of numerical instability, you end up with negative pressure, temperature, whatever. And so what really would be nice is a hybrid method which is very high order away from the shocks but can still handle the shocks in order to do very high mass number calculations of this kind which are interesting to the physicists.
You calculate also the spectrum of sound emission?
No, we don't. It's a good question, but the emphasis for us has not really been acoustics. None of us who work on this problem are acousticians. So we are rather uncomfortable getting into that. The business is kind of complicated. I am aware that Sarkar and his student looked at sound emissions from decaying compressible turbines, but then look at DNS of turbines and then look at the far field sound emission.
I didn't pay attention to one of the first slides where you gave the background, this kind of tube-like thing where it could be shot from the detonation from entered into the rest of the
right.
Chamber. Is that rocket related or what?
No, that's part of what we call the ASCII virtual test facility.
What is that?
ASCII is the Accelerated Strategic Computing Initiative. It's a DOE program. It's a DOE funded program at Caltech. There are five main centers.
It's the Richmeyer mesh of instability. I mean, fluid dynamically, that's what it is.
Yeah.
And it occurs whenever you try to compress the material with the shocker.
Well, I thought there might be a kind of applied question in the background.
There is.
Well,
laser fusion.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
If you are handling order h to the 9th, is that right? Accurate for the difference for
h to the 10th.
H to the 10th. You are switching them on and off as needed.
No, this all the runs that I showed, I should have mentioned this in the talk, were all 10th order accurate runs.
Machinery.
Each of those high resolution runs, the 256 cube runs, takes about, depends on how long you want to compute, but a ballpark number takes about 50 hours on 128 processors on an IBM SP2. It takes a couple of weeks because you have to subtend the operating system. So the wall clock turnaround time can be anywhere between 2 to 3 weeks per run.
So is this done with Caltech or remote?
All these simulations were done in at the on the Yosemite platforms. They were done at Los Alamos, Yosemite Blue Mountain, or Lawrence Livermore, Yosemite Blue Pacific. And the earliest code that we are running now at 32 cube and 48 cube, that we run them locally.
Well, nice work.
Thanks.